Thanks for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that Answers Network is a channel and website that you can go to for special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media groups and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we together can make a positive influence in the world. Now, our guest today is the award-winning author of New York Times best-selling books, Fearless and The Only Thing Worth Dying For, which were followed by Legend, which is an unforgettable account of the U.S. Army's 140th Assault Helicopter Company and Green Beret Medal of Honor recipient, Roy Benavidez, who risked everything to rescue a special forces team trapped behind enemy lines during the Vietnam War. Now, both Fearless and Legend are currently being adapted for film by major Hollywood producers and studios. Now, in his current book, The Darkest White, A Mountain Legend, The Avalanche, and The Avalanche That Took Him, our guest, Eric Blem, returned to his mountain roots to tell the story of snowboarding's original superstar who walked away from the fame and fortune associated with competition to return to the pottery backcountry that originally drew him to his calling and unfortunately ultimately took his life. Now, The Darkest White is a gripping and heartfelt story of a bold, short life, yet well-lived, says New York Times bestselling author Hampton Sides. Tony Hawk stated, "This book is not just for fans of snowboarding, but for anyone looking for inspiration from an unlikely hero." Eric, welcome to Answers Network.
Alan, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. I have had a very enjoyable week learning more about you, about your writing, and about Craig Kelly. And it's interesting because it's a story that I didn't know, and yet all of this was happening during my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So it's been very enjoyable for me. So I thank you for that.
For sure. Thank you.
Now, before we dive right into talking about the new book, share with our audience kind of your early days in journalism so that they can kind of get an idea, because, you know, I found that as I was reading the different things that you were doing, I'm like, wow, this is great. Oh, this is another great subject. Oh, I like this too. So you've really kind of spread your wings and you've gone into a lot of different areas.
Yeah. I mean, narrative nonfiction and journalism is my forte. And I that old adage of the truth is stranger than fiction. I love true stories and, you know, ordinary people that have experienced, extraordinary things. I honestly, Alan, my path to snowboard or to journalism was through snowboarding. In the 80s, I wanted to be a pro snowboarder. And my mom died when I was 17 years old. And literally on her deathbed, she said, "If there's anything you want to do in life, do it now, because you never know about tomorrow." And she was 60 years old. I was the youngest of four kids, 17. And even though I went to junior college, a local community college down in Palomar College in San Marcos, California, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, except that I wanted to snowboard. So I moved to Breckenridge, Colorado, which was the hotbed of snowboarding in the I graduated high school in 1987. So in the mid to late 80s, if you wanted to be a pro snowboarder, Breckenridge was one of the only big Western ski areas that allowed snowboarding. We weren't allowed on slopes most places. I mean, Time Magazine voted snowboarding the worst new sport of 1988, literally. And they said it wasn't about like the grace of skiing. It was about raging hormones. I mean, this is what we were up against. So to compress all this time together, I ended up getting injured. And I was sponsored for a while. And I competed for a couple of years, but I blew my knee out and then a shoulder injury. And I had met a guy on a chairlift. And I think this is for your audience, especially, you know, with just finding things that can help you further your way down this path we all are living. This guy ended up being a travel writer, and he was there doing a story about Breckenridge for a newspaper. And he ended up telling me, I said, "Well, really, that's crazy. Did you major in anything?" And he said, "Journalism." I had never even heard that word. I had no idea what journalism was. So when I blew my knee out and hurt my shoulder, I thought, you know what? I want to live in this world, but I'm not going to be a pro. I'm not going to be Craig Kelly at the time, or like to be a kid saying, I'm not going to be Sean White. That realization hit me. And so I went back to school and I thought I could write for the snowboarding magazines. And, you know, both for me and for my mom, my parents were workaholics. We never had money to travel, always putting things off. You know, then she got cancer and she passed away 4 years later. And so I thought I could see the world. Even if I can't afford it, I can do it on someone else's dime as a journalist. And that's really how I got to the snowboarding world. And I ended up becoming the editor of the world's largest snowboarding magazine, traveled around the world, writing feature stories and meeting my heroes and doing all of this. And that was kind of my journey. And The Darkest White is a full circle, because after writing for the magazines, I ended up going kind of off on a different path, different subjects, special operations forces in the military, a backcountry ranger who went missing mysteriously in the High Sierra. Always nonfiction, but I went, you know, as you know, stories will take you places, and each one led to a different story. And after many years, 15 years of writing these other types of stories, I realized that Craig's story had never been told. He had been killed 15 years earlier, and his story had never been told. And I mean, to wrap this long, convoluted, circuitous answer back, I was in a chairlift line in Utah 15 years after Craig passed away, and this kid looked over at my snowboard, and I had a sticker all these years that a lot of us had who loved Craig, that said, "Craig Kelly is my co-pilot." And he looked down at my sticker and he just said with all sincerity, "Who's Craig Kelly?" And to me, in my era, Craig Kelly was the Michael Jordan of snowboarding. It was unfathomable to me that no one knew who he was. And that's when it hit me. I'm all, wow, he's being forgotten to history. And the new generation doesn't know who this guy was, who was our hero. I mean, it would be like going to a pickup basketball game wearing a Michael Jordan jersey at some, you know, half court somewhere, and a kid looking at it and saying, "Who's Michael Jordan?" Wow. That was what it was to me. And so that was what started this whole journey to tell Craig's story and how I got into journalism and why it is a full circle for me.
Well, I had no intention of telling this story, but when you just said that, it's where it took me. When you talk about the fact of where you're talking with a young person and how it makes you feel when you say something, you know, you mention someone and they're like, "Who is that?" I was working with an at-risk youth. I was taking him to a specialized program many years ago, and a song came on the radio by the Traveling Wilburys. And I made mention of George Harrison, you know, and how it was hard for me to really think about him, you know, in any other band. And he said to me, he goes, "George Harrison was in another band before this."
Oh my gosh.
And I went, "How can you not know this?"
Amazing, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So now I didn't go out and write a book about George Harrison or the Beatles, but
there'd been a couple done, so you didn't have that obligation.
Yeah. I was going to say, it wouldn't have been anything new. Anyway, that was what it triggered in me as you were telling that story. So I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And so that everybody understands, because I think you kind of, you went over this rather quickly in regards to some of the other things that you wrote. But from my research, what I learned was that you were out there at a time in which, as far as, you know, in war zones, before that became a thing. Is that about right?
I was embedded. It was a training mission, but I was allowed into the special operations community. I was embedded with a platoon of Army Rangers in 1999. So it's pre-9/11. Mm-hmm. And they weren't really letting access to journalists in these special operations forces at the time.
Right.
And I was able to embed and basically try and keep pace with a platoon of Army Rangers on a training mission in a mock war. So it wasn't actually, I wasn't deployed and embedded during 9/11, but what it was kind of an experiment for the special operations community to say, hey, what would it be like to actually have a journalist with us? And for me, it was 36 hours of hell. I mean, I was carried their rucksack. And at that time, it was Korean War era rucksacks. And I also, there was a story that we did about how the modern, like all this modern mountaineering gear and fabrics and stuff was being used by civilian mountaineers and, you know, people that are out up against the wilds, and our military, even at the highest level, we're using, like, you know, cotton fatigues and horrible, you know, the technology was had not caught up. And so that was kind of how I got involved with that, is researching an article about, you know, today's modern army versus today's modern recreationalist mountaineer. And they invited me to come along and keep pace with these guys. They gave me their night vision goggles, and I trudged through this rainforest on the Oregon coast with them for 36 hours with hardly any sleep to see really what these guys do. And it gave me a whole new appreciation once 9/11 began and people started being dropped into Afghanistan. And that was really, for me, that was what kind of led me to tell those stories. I had never served the military, and all this patriotism was occurring at 9/11. And I thought, what's my part in all this? What can I do? And I thought I could tell the stories, you know, at that point, like Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, all these movies were coming out. And there was a lot of focus saying the World War II veterans, a lot of them are dying off and their stories are dying with them. And they've never talked about it. And I thought, well, this is my current generation, our current greatest generation. And what better time to maybe document what's going on while they're still, you know, it's fresh in their minds. And that really what put me down this path of writing the stories about those who serve for several years, you know, three books that took anywhere from a year and a half to write to four and a half years to write. So 12 years of telling these stories of our modern warriors, and also diving back into the Vietnam era, which was, I was born in 1968. So I thought, and I had a Vietnam veteran as a neighbor when I was a latchkey kid growing up. And I thought, hey, you know, let's honor these warriors, men and or women, that are, you know, serving their country.
Well, I'm glad that you shared that. And as I put in the introduction, I know two of your books are now being being looked at as turning them into movies. And for anybody out there, if there's a movie that you like, and if it came from a book, I strongly suggest read that book. You will get so much more out of that movie if you read that book. So again, I'm glad you shared with that, because when these come out, I want people to understand that there's a lot more information in the book that will help you really enjoy a movie when it's written like that.
Hallelujah. I agree completely. I actually just rewatched We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson, and of the story, and the book was We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And the book is allows you to understand what's going on during the chaos of that battle, the first helicopter battle in Vietnam.
Yep. No, I agree. Now, this is probably going to be more for me than everybody else out there. I love research. And I can tell as I was reading your book that you must love research also. So, you know, talk a little bit about the dedication, you know, that it takes as far as researching a book like, you know, The Darkest White, as well as some of your other books. You know, share just kind of some of the challenges, maybe some of the revelations that you encounter, and particularly, you know, when you were investigating things like, you know, a glacier avalanche.
Right. Well, the Darkest White, first of all, Craig Kelly was born in what was became known as the Durand Glacier Avalanche. It was January 20th, 2003, quite a few years ago when I started writing this book. It had been, you know, close to 15 years since it had occurred. And one of the challenges is always the passage of time. And in an avalanche situation, in this case, just to put your readers in a moment in the book, imagine you're a guide And your job is to take people up into the mountains. They would climb the mountains and then ski down them or snowboard down them. There were 21 people with in two groups, two guides, an assistant guide and a lead guide. And you're at the top of a run and you're the leader of this entire group. They're trusting you with their lives. And this avalanche occurs and you look down over the edge. And in an instant, 13 people have disappeared from the landscape. And they have literally seconds in some cases to only a few minutes of air underneath the snow. And it's your job with one trained guide plus seven other clients that are with you. They're not even other guides, but they're trained. They've been trained in like very briefly, but they're fairly trained backcountry aficionados. And everybody's wearing a electronic transceiver that emits a beep and you turn it to receive and then you hear the beeping. But imagine a massive avalanche has occurred 2,000 feet below you. It's rubble everywhere and you have to get down there and find those 13 people. After 15 minutes, before 15 minutes, it's a 50% chance that they will survive. And again, 13 people gone from the landscape. That is what you're dealing with. So it was chaos in a word. And so imagine that and the passage of time and how do you put this together in a timeline. And for me, there were a lot of questions about this avalanche. First of all, why were they there in the first place? And the snowpack, the snow science of that culture, and how people predict avalanches. You get a sense of all of these things that people do when they go into the mountains to ascertain whether a slope is safe, where to travel in the mountains, all these things. So I build that up in the book. And you understand the whole situation, but then you have this moment where basically all hell breaks loose. And what I've always done in my books in order to try and piece together some semblance of order in chaos is you just talk to everybody. You speak to everybody who is there, and there's always places where their memories intersect. And like whether it's one person, I remember when the so-and-so yelled out, "I've got so-and-so." And then you're like, okay, boom, there's a timeline moment that we can trust. Two or three people remember this. And then another one here and another one here. And then you slowly piece this together. And I was also lucky enough that a lot of the survivors of this avalanche ended up taking their own notes that evening and their own diaries. And they were interviewed by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And I got access to these interviews that happened in some cases hours after the avalanche, in other cases days. And in one other case, you know, about a year later, so pretty current times that allowed me to kind of take a look at what happened then, compare it with these interviews I had now, because I interviewed almost every single survivor who was there, went through all the official reports, an accident reports, an independent investigation. All these things allow you to kind of piece together what I believe is the most accurate account of one of the most tragic avalanches in North American backcountry skiing and snowboarding history.
Well, how did you approach these individuals and how did you gain their trust? Because I would imagine with these survivors, you know, this is probably one of their, you know, one of their big nightmare moments that probably comes back to haunt them.
Worst day of their life.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in all my cases, I mean, in these other stories of war where people have lost, you know, loved ones, what has given me the permission to go into these dark places in people's memories is back when I wrote The Only Thing Worth Dying For. I met the father and mother of Daniel H. Pettitori, who was one of the first special forces killed after 9/11, December 5th, 2001, in a friendly fire incident. And when I stayed at their house for a weekend. And I got to know Dan's favorite breakfast. I slept in his room. I saw the medal that he got posthumously. And the father, when I was leaving, said, "Listen, Eric, I know by meeting you that you're going to do a great job. But do me a favor. Don't candy coat it. Tell it like it happened. That's how you can honor my son. That's how you can honor the memory of all those who have fallen." And that was such a great thing for me as a younger journalist to get that permission from a loved one saying, "Hey, you know what? Dan believed in accountability. If he messed up, let people learn from it." And so I learned that telling the truth is the best way to do it. So I'm always just honest with people. I say, I am after just the truth. I'm not trying to expose anything, but things can be learned. And in this case, absolutely, in this avalanche, you know, the lead guide was vilified afterwards, like, you led these people to their deaths. And he didn't want to talk to me at all. And other people did. But ultimately, I just introduced myself and let them know what I wanted to do. And they all came around, including the lead guide. He ultimately said, you know what, Eric, let's talk. And for me, that is just a testament to that. First of all, the truth really will set you free. I think when people have these dark things in their mind and or hate or whatever it might be, writing about it is, and or just telling it is therapy, and it's cathartic. And I think it helped a lot of them. Many of the people said they had not spoken of this in all these years at all. They'd sucked it in forever. And in doing so, I learned things that were never reported before. And that's what made it such a, for me, an eye-opening experience. For me, walking in the doors of the Durand Glacier Chalet, which was kind of their base camp, when I went in there 15 years later, and after reading and interviewing people, and the whole place came alive. And I felt like I was opening the door of a cold case, honestly. Wow. And that was really what you can respect and understand from what you do. And I was able to open up these doors. And since the book has come out, I've gotten a lot of thank yous from people saying, wow, I really can understand how this happened. And in an unbiased way, that's another thing. I mean, Craig was a friend of mine and a hero. And so clearly I'm not an unbiased biographer. So I went into it with my own preconceptions, but I had to step back and say, I need to be fair and let and understand what was the mindset of these guides when they led these people to this particular slope, and let's let it play out. Let me see how it occurred and what was going on in their minds. And that, again, had never been told before. And that's right. Why I did it, to honor Craig, to honor all the people who were killed that day, to really tell for the first time the whole story of this tragic avalanche.
All right. We're speaking with Eric Blem. The book is called The Darkest White. We're going to pick up this story as soon as we come back. So stay with us. You're watching or listening to Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
We're back. We're talking with Eric Blem. We're talking about Craig Kelly's story. If you're just joining us, the book is called The Darkest White. And so, Eric, I'm blessed with the fact that I've had the opportunity to read it. And to me, the book promises to reveal a lot of never before reported details. You were talking about that when we went to break, about the avalanche that claimed Craig's life. You mentioned he was also a friend. Is that what motivated you to dig deeper into this tragic situation? And what do you hope the readers will take away from these revelations that you uncovered?
Craig was a friend. And so, I think first and foremost, I wanted to introduce Craig to the world. Like I said earlier, I realized that he's kind of being forgotten to this, not forgotten, but it was unknown to the current generation. Mm-hmm. And with snowboarding, the most popular, most watched event in the Olympics now, and people like Shaun White and Chloe Kim just, soaring beyond your wildest dreams of these crazy tricks, going, 30 feet in the air above the half pipe and things like that. They don't understand that once upon a time, there was a kid, a sport that was an unknown sport. And Craig Kelly, he was a cerebral, smart kid. He was getting a degree in chemical engineering at the University of Washington when snowboarding was just coming into play. But he was quite good at it, and he was dedicated. And there was a fledgling contest circuit. And he thought, I'm going to try and become a pro snowboarder in a sport that doesn't even exist. So he stepped aside from a very lucrative and, kind of a standard career route in life to try out for the thing. And he ended up being the guy who became like the really the ambassador to snowboarding, that brought snowboarding and skiing together and attracted people to try snowboarding. And he could talk the talk, but he could walk the walk. He was beautiful to watch on the hill. So first and foremost, that's what I wanted to do with the book. Second, I wanted people to understand a little bit about the history of snowboarding and where it came from, because it, again, it's such a, you know, household name and everybody knows what it is now. But then third, it's this, you know, everybody loves to go, you know, whether, you know, you're an armchair adventurer or a true mountaineer or a climber, you know, there's this mystique with the mountains, like John Krakauer's books, you know, into thin air, or, you know, Touching the Void, Joe Simpson, these amazing, iconic, you know, household legends in mountaineering. And that is really what Craig was doing. He, using a snowboard as his tool, you know, wanted to go deeper and deeper into the backcountry. And by, you know, encountering this avalanche, it was really just a great story. You know, it was an unknown story. It was a mystery that had really been untold. And so I wanted to, again, you know, honor Craig because he was a friend. But as I got to know the survivors and the people who lost loved ones, I more and more realized it's bigger than Craig. It's bigger than all of us and them. There's lessons to be learned in this, you know, long past incident. And I really, really, it became kind of a calling at that point. And it took me 5 years to write, you know, Alan. And I think one of the reasons, you know, people said, gosh, that's one of the longer times it's taken me to write a book. But I think part of the reason was because I knew it was coming at the end. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of the books I've written honor and the legacy of people who have passed, whether they're warriors that have served our country, to this a backcountry ranger, to Craig. You get to know these people, you admire them, you understand that they are human. And then all of a sudden there's this tragic incident. And I think that there's always things that can be learned. And then there's also just nature, you know, nature always wins. And maybe that's the lesson in this. You know, you can do all you want, but there are going to be situations where all the training in the world won't prepare you for whatever it might be. And is it worth it? Is it worth the risks of going out there and experiencing this? And I don't want to answer that question, but as you read the book and as people read the book, they can get a sense for what Craig and others get out of what they would do. And they can ask themselves, you know what? Would I do that? Would I risk my life for powder to go out and get untracked snow in the backcountry? I think the tragedy was that Craig at the end was learning to be safer in the mountains. He was training to become a mountain guide. That was his evolution of as a snowboarder. Right. And he was a recent, a new father as well. And mm-hmm. one of the things that got him interested in doing this was he had himself said, I was often selfish as a snowboarder. It was always about me and getting, you know, my trips and my adventures around the world. But when he had a child, he realized the magic in sharing. And so what better way to share the mountains than to become a guide? And so that was what he was endeavoring to become when this occurred. And it sounds like such a downer. And it's, I don't want people, you read the book and you are, it's a bright light. Craig was such a bright light.
And well, I think that's a great point that you bring up, because I didn't get that feeling at all. In fact, it's more of a celebration of
it is a celebration. Yeah.
You know, and that was more the feeling that I got. But what I noticed was that Craig's decision to turn away from fame and fortune and return to the backcountry is a central theme in your book. What do you perceive was Craig's mindset and the factors that led him to prioritize his passion over commercial success? Because that's during a time in which, you know, many of us, you know, would have looked at the potential of you know, commercial success, the potential of, you know, becoming the you know, the go-to person for sponsorships and things like that.
Right.
Take us there, because that was something that I thought kind of made him so very unique.
Yeah.
In that respect.
He was a competitor and he brought discipline to the sport, and he was all about for a long time. At first it was, I love titles. I love earning titles. Then it was like, I love earning the money, because sponsors would match his winnings. And then ultimately he was able to get a contract of the livable contract and, just to snowboard. But at that point, everybody who was getting sponsored was a competitor. There was no such thing as a snowboarder who would go out and snowboard for fun and get paid to do it. And he kind of turned that corner. He got to the point where he realized, you know, titles are important and the money is important, but he was such a ball of stress. He started to realize that why did he really get into it? What is it that made him fall in love with the sport? And that was free riding, just going out and enjoying the mountain and nature mm-hmm. and riding the whole mountain, however you want to, kind of your blank canvas. The mountain is your canvas and you can go, you know, making your strokes upon that white canvas. And mm-hmm. so when he realized that, being the smart guy that he was, he also realized, well, that's what most people are. You know, there's not too many kids that are watching the Olympics that are then going to turn around and do what Shaun White and, you know, Chloe Kim and Mark Morris and all these other mm-hmm. pro athletes are doing. But they're going to go out and have a good time and ride. And so he knew that there was that as well. So he thought, why can't I be this inspiration and encourage people that, hey, just go out and have a good time. One of the last questions he was asked was, who is your favorite? Who do you respect the most now as he was turning this corner in his career to go toward the backcountry? And he said, I'm going to paraphrase it, but it's in the book. But he basically says, while I'm constantly like astounded by these superhuman extreme tricks that kids are doing on the mountain and in the half pipe, the rider that I have the most respect for is the average kid that's just out there for the experience. And I mean, I just paraphrased mm-hmm. it, but that was what a legacy of a quote, where he had the opportunity on this world stage, as you know, very big magazine asked him this question. He could have pumped up anybody. And instead he just basically said, you know what? The kids that I respect the most are the ones that are just out there for the experience. And what a beautiful thing. And that's really comes back to that mindset you asked about, where mm-hmm. Craig realized that it was this experience that made him fall in love with the sport. And he wanted to share that and to say, hey, you don't have to be this crazy stunt man or woman, you know, pulling off the craziest tricks and risking life and limb, whatever. You can honestly go out and have a great adventure just, you know, at the resorts or whatever. And by doing that, he became such a spokesperson for what was known as just free riding, riding the whole mountain for fun.
Right. Now I love that. And I think that there are so many sports, you know, there are some for those of us that have been very competitive in one sport or another. There are other sports that if you can take them on, it's more like therapy. You know, don't try to, you know, compete in it as much as, you know, against anybody else, as much as just competing against yourself to enjoy it to the very best you can.
Yeah, just like surfing. It's not necessarily about catching the wave. It's just getting in the water. It's not about catching fish. It's about going fishing and walking down the creek or, you know, being on the water. And he realized that. And it was very therapeutic for him. And he once said, you know, he grew up as a latchkey kid of divorced parents and made all this happen on his own, very independent. It's an inspirational story where he came from to become the most well-known for that era. I mean, he can't overstate how synonymous with snowboarding he was at the time. You know, he was on Rolling Stone and, you know, all the magazines covered him. He was the first one to have a movie of his own biopic called The Smooth Groove. In snowboarding history, for the first wave of snowboarders, there's nobody who didn't know who Craig Kelly was. And again, that's why I wanted people to understand it today, because there's so much push and pressure in a lot of life. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's important mm-hmm. for sure. But there also is a place for just, you know, finding a passion and doing it for the sake of how it makes you feel, not what you're going to win.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. We have a listener question that's coming in. This one reads, and actually it came in, which I want to point this out for anybody that's sending in messages. We get some that come in ahead of time because the show is going out live here in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. And so we get things like from teachers that say, you know, I'm sending you this question now because I'm not going to be able to listen live.
Right.
But when I do listen, I'd like to have an answer for it. So again, so this one that had come in and probably right after our press release went out. But this one reads, about 14 years ago, when I was 15 years old at the time, my parents sent me to a boarding school in Northern California that used snowboarding as a way of teaching life skills and bonding. It was one of the best things in my life, although at first I hated the idea. Once I got away from some of my friends who were toxic and many of my public school teachers who pushed an agenda of what to think rather than how to think, I focused on nature and how to trust myself and those around me. My life grew in a very positive way. What was your overall takeaway from your time with the snowboarding community? And this is from Ryan in Denver, Colorado.
That's beautiful. Wow. I mean, it chokes me up. It's just because snowboarding for me really just, it gave me a path in life. Like I said, for me, I wanted to find a way that, you know, my parents were workaholics and I thought, you know, by snowboarding and realizing I could write about snowboarding for a magazine, my message to, well, what I tried to achieve was, you know, you can have a career, but it's important to live life along the way. And, you know, maybe, you know, like my mom, always putting off, you know, vacations and for retirement, workaholics couldn't afford whatever, always behind the eight ball when they could have done certain things. And it got to the point where all of a sudden, bam, she has terminal cancer and battled cancer for 4 years and left me with amazing, you know, advice that has shaped my life. So I realized that snowboarding was kind of the tool, I guess you could say, or the pivot point for me that just gave me a way that I could have a career, but also a passion. And I did go to college after, you know, and when I went to get my degree in journalism, one of the instructors said once to me, you know, in life, there's your job, there's jobs and work, and your job is what pays the rent, but your work is what fulfills you. And if you can find work, you'll never have to work another day in your life. And I feel fortunate that I've been able to achieve that as an author and as a writer, but it all came from snowboarding. So yeah, snowboarding gave me that sense of, I love this. It's a place I will always have it. You know, if everything goes wrong and everything's horrible or whatever it might be, there's nothing a good day of snowboarding now with my kids or just by myself that it won't cure. There's nothing a powder day won't cure for me mentally. And, you know, it takes me to my happy place. What more can I say? Snowboarding takes me to my happy place.
I love that. And I think for everybody out there, it's for you to figure out where your happy place is. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. The book is called The Darkest White. If you know somebody that you go, hey, wait, I got a friend. You know what? Shoot them a message real quick and tell them to tune in. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network. Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. West Shield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. West Shield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. West Shield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step. And we're back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network. We're speaking with Eric Blem, and we are talking about his new book, The Darkest White. So, Eric, as I was reading different things, I noticed that that this book is being compared to books like Into the Wild and other adventure-type narratives. How do you feel your storytelling approach differs, and what do you think sets The Darkest White apart in this genre?
Well, first of all, I have to say thank you. And for the people who have said that, I'm humbled to be mentioned in the same league as those books that have been just around such a long shelf life and the stories that inspired so many people. The Perfect Storm is another example of one about, you know, the Andrea Gale crab fishing boat that Sebastian Younger wrote is another amazing book. But what sets mine apart, I think that, you know, there's so many different stories of survival and mountain adventure, climbing, whatever it is. But this is really like it's three books in one. It's a biography blended into a whole, the, you know, kind of tells the beginning of an entire sport and subculture. And then it all kind of comes together into this kind of a reverse engineering of a tragic avalanche. And I don't believe there's ever been an avalanche story told where an author has put together to the extent I did this reverse engineering of this tragedy, everything from the snow science involved that year, speaking with nearly all of the survivors, and really dissecting the reports that were made. And I think that's what sets it apart. It's really a wide look at a narrow topic, if that makes sense. And it's never been done. And people have said that. They've said this is the most raw and horrifying but a fair look at a tragedy like this. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's what sets it apart. I think that you're going to get a very unbiased look at something that a lot of people have their own ideas of what happened. And now you get to like get into the minds of the people who were there because they finally, after all this time, decided to disclose things that they'd held inside all these years. And I credit that to myself for doing the research, but I credit that to the people who trusted me and ultimately were brave enough to share things that they'd kept inside for many years. And that's not an easy thing to do. So I couldn't have done it without every one of the people that opened up to me and told me their stories, their individual stories.
Well, as a fellow research junkie, I really appreciate that part of it. And in many books, I look at, you know, what did I learn? And I felt not only did I learn a lot more about an entire culture and how it got started, but I didn't know anything about avalanche. I didn't know exactly what causes them. I didn't know how long you can survive under there. I mean, there's so many different things, but yet, you know, they make movies and they show it, but you really don't know anything as far as, you know, the depths of it. And so again, my feeling was I came away learning about things that I really didn't. And I didn't know Craig and didn't know his story. So you're right. It was like three different areas,
right,
to learn about. And again, anybody like me that's a research junkie, I'm eating that up.
Yeah, no, I mean, you never know what turn or what bit of evidence or, you know, research is going to come out from that next person. It's really hard to stop researching when you finally realize I have enough to tell the story. And I did at one point, but I honestly, there is one person, for instance, didn't speak to me for, you know, after, you know, 3 years after I first reached out to him. And then all of a sudden this person came back and said, "Hey, I read your book the last season about this. And I realized I put it together that you wrote that book and it's one of my favorite books of all time." And he didn't know, because my name isn't John Grisham or Stephen King. You know, I'm not a household name yet. But it was neat that he then turned around and said, "I want to talk to you." And that was at the 11th hour of writing this book. And then he became one of my most valuable sources because he had such insights and had kept such careful notes and opened it all up to me at the end. So research really, it's revealing.
Well, and again, we just talked about the fact that it really went into three different areas. As you reflect into the journey of writing it, are there particular moments that stand out as being more impactful or more emotional to you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes you get a moment that you, well, let's say before Craig went into the backcountry on that trip, he had a conversation with his mother, you know, and then it was cut off because of bad cell coverage. And you know, the last words that he said, you know, before he went into the backcountry was a huge moment. And reading Craig's own personal journals and diaries and then be able to insert those in moments. I did a lot of research on what happens to the human body physiologically when you're under the snow. And, you know, much like Sebastian Younger recounts what it means to drown physiologically, I talked about that and this idea of does your life flash before your eyes? And I found studies of people who had survived near-death experiences and their experience to try and ascertain what could have been going on in Craig's mind. And in that way, very honestly, I never took the liberty of saying this is what happened, but with a lot of research and speaking to people who knew Craig best, I was able to put together what I believe is a very safe bet of what was going on in that horrible time and what was going on in his mind. And by doing that, it was tough. I mean, it was horrifying to let yourself go into that position of being, you know, people said that when you're buried by the snow compacts around you. You know, when you feel, when you get your blood pressure taken, that grip that you get on that arm cuff. Well, imagine that's the full body. And then, you know, your breath melts the snow and it makes an ice muzzle. And slowly you feel the oxygen and that claustrophobia and the darkness and what's going on in your mind. But yet you're hopeful because you know that someone on top is looking for you. And by, you know, and people did survive. And so by talking about to the different people that are involved, those were to me some of the most impactful moments of the research. And at the end of in the story, it's kind of like a train wreck where you know it's coming, but you can't take your eyes off it.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes. Are there any particular memorable responses that you've received from readers that you would like to share?
I mean, Simon Winchester was the person who reviewed it for the New York Times, and I was fortunate enough to get a rave review by the New York Times Book Review. And something he said, again, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was, he talked about how he didn't know anything about snowboarding, and honestly, before reading the book, didn't care. But this book brought that to life, and he said, and despite all that, he said, this book is one of the most unremittingly exciting books of nonfiction he's come across in years. And that meant the world to me. Simon Winchester, the amazing nonfiction author and researcher himself, and to be in the New York Times. So I got that's a feather in my cap that I will hold. I will let wave proudly forever, you know. And other people, really honestly, I think maybe the best would have been Craig's dad, who said when he read it, he said it was slow reading through certain parts. And I was like, oh, well, that's not what a writer wants here. He said, no, it was slow because I couldn't stop wiping the tears because you captured who Craig was as this humble hero. And to get that from his father was by far the most, I think, the nicest thing that I've heard. And you couldn't ask for anything more than to say that you portrayed my son with honor and with accuracy. And that was beautiful. It was amazing. Thank you, Pat Kelly.
Wow. Eric, again, thank you. And are there any other future projects? What's your next book that you're working on? Anything that you can share with us?
You know, it's live here and we're up, you know, you're in Los Angeles area. So actually I'm going to be at Warwick's Bookstore in La Jolla, which is south, but on Wednesday night. And it's one of the oldest. It is the oldest independent family operated bookstores in America, and they're disappearing at an alarming rate. So if you want to go and support them and meet me, I'll be there on Wednesday. Warwick's in La Jolla in the Village, San Diego. I was invited to speak at the Banff Mountain Book Festival next October in Canada. The book was a Canadian bestseller, by the way. The avalanche took place in Canada. BC Canada. Mm-hmm. My website, www.ericblem.com, has any future events. The book can be purchased anywhere books are sold, and an audio, ebook, whatever you like. And yeah, just, you know, tell a friend. And I'm honored to share Craig's story and the story to honor all those who were killed in this avalanche, to finally get it out there all these years later. It's, you know, it's a winter book, but from what I've been told, it's a pretty good beach read as well. So it's summertime, and there you go. There you have it. I appreciate it.
All right. And you mentioned Warwick's in La Jolla. And so Wednesday will be June 26th. What time?
I believe you have to look it up, but I believe it's either 6 or 7 p.m.
Okay.
The two. And as far as my next book, I'm actually, I can't really say what it is quite yet. So many years of research, but I'm going to be teaching at San Diego State University this coming fall, doing some lecturing. During that time, kind of almost like a writer in residence, I'll be working on a pretty cool book that it takes place in Colombia. And it's a story of a girl whose father was abducted by the FARC for many years. And it's a pretty special story. And I'm hoping I can bring that to light in the next year or two.
All right. Well, if there's anything I can help you with on that, let me know.
Okay.
Eric, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing people's stories and reminding the world that we have heroes of all kinds.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And all your listeners, just follow your heart, find that path. You'll find the answer in the journey.
Excellent. Thank you. And if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you click on the like button. And if you're interested in seeing more content like this, please check out our past shows on our channel, our website, which is answers.network, or any major social media platform. And for everybody out there, take a moment today to do something kind for someone else. Whether it's a small gesture or a big act, your kindness can brighten someone's day and create a ripple effect of positivity. Now, you'd be amazed at how good it feels when you make a difference. Let's spread a little more love and compassion in the world. And remember, it starts with us. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.